We've been looking at some things in James, in the book of James, operating on the principle that the Epistle of James presents a number of issues that challenge faith, and these issues are common to all. Success will be achieved when faith is employed. And it is as though James is asking, how is your faith when it comes to all these issues? We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 13 tonight. And in particular, we're interested in this. How is your faith when it comes to respect of persons? Respect of persons is the phrase that's found in the King James Version and the American Standard Version. It's partiality, most places, in the New King James Version and the English Standard Version. And in the New American Standard Bible, at least in James chapter 2 and verse 1, it's personal favoritism, partiality other places. And the word that's in the original language means to have respect or respect of outward circumstances of man, not to their intrinsic merits. And so prefers as the most worthy one who is rich, high-born, or powerful, to another who does not have these qualities. Probably the difference between rich and poor here and the respective persons that's employed, quite possibly the people who felt this the worst in the first century were those that we looked at last week, the widows and orphans. They would certainly feel the effect of this perhaps more than anyone. And in the first century, there was, in a number of cases, a sense of polarization. And I believe that this is something that's specifically addressed. And we find it in passages that we're familiar with. For example, Galatians chapter 3 and verse 28. Now here it's addressing this, where it says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free man, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And the polarization of the first century would center around these things, as well as a number of others. Colossians chapter 3, a lot of times we know about the one there in Galatians 3, but there's one in Colossians chapter 3, verse 11, that's similar to this. Colossians 3 and verse 11, where it calls for a renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and free man, but Christ is all and in all. Now the Scythian is kind of a borrowed term. A Scythian was someone who, where the country actually was, or the region, was actually in what we would call kind of southern Russia, around the Black Sea, Caspian Sea, along in there. And it was kind of borrowed over to mean barbarians of barbarians. So when he refers here to a barbarian and then a Scythian, he says barbarians, and everybody, you know, that's worse than that. And so it's kind of a used in that way. But once again, you know, these are things that polarized individuals. And Peter admitted himself when Peter went to the house of Cornelius. Go back to Acts chapter 10. Peter admitted that he had to overcome this himself, and that it was something that was important. And the reason he overcame this is because this is what God had told him, had shown him, instructed him. It has reference back to the vision that he had. But in Acts chapter 10, verses 28 and 29, he said to them, now that's those in the house, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet God has shown me. So now see, he's talking about himself there at this association. God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That is why I came without even raising an objection when I was sent for. So I asked for what reason you have sent for me. So in other words, you know, he was of that persuasion before, but God had shown him something different. And since God had shown him something different, the other, well, it doesn't enter into the picture. I'll go with you. It'll be fine. Verses 34 and 35, opening his mouth, Peter said, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality or respect of persons. But in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. Pretty plain language. And so we can understand the sense of polarization. We can understand how Peter worked at this, and it was something that he needed to overcome himself, as well as a number of other Jews would have to overcome this, and other things that enter into the picture. And this doesn't just vanish by magic. Great effort must be expended to eliminate respective persons. Now, it's going to take that. Now, today, we have polarization as well. It may differ, it may be in different forms, it may not exactly be like this, but we have it. And I think we're painfully aware of this. And respect of persons, when you get down to James chapter 2, if you turn over there for just a minute. Now I want everybody to turn there too. I'll wait. But James chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Now, this is something that's important. But if you show partiality or respect of persons or some kind of personal favoritism, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, dare we say this point, he has become guilty of all. Well, that puts it in a serious light. And yet, I think I've seen, of all things out of brethren, more instances of respect of persons being shown than maybe anything else. And not a thought given to it. Now, I don't mean people are just being, you know, brazen in this. They just don't realize sometimes that that's actually, you know, what I'm doing. And, well, it may not be what you may not understand what you're doing, but it doesn't mean that it's still not serious, and it doesn't mean that you ought to stop this. I would think to myself sometimes, I fancied the idea that racism had become better in our country, I mean our handling of it and so on. Then I lived in the South for 8 years. And I found out, I don't know if it's actually gone away. I think it's just shoved back in the closet pretty deep. But I think it's been replaced by other things. A person who has respect of persons in one area may have it in a number of others. It's not generally just limited to one. And no matter where the focus might be, this sin of respecting persons relies on being biased, prejudiced, or, of course, racist. And it still exists today. James deals with this showing partiality between rich and poor. But again, we would understand this could be manifest in any number of ways. Let me suggest a few to you. Ethnically, you know, where a person might come from. I think that the racism towards African Americans is gradually being replaced by another type of ethnic racism towards people of the Mexican persuasion or people who are just, you know, brown skinned. And yet, you know, there are those that know, well, I shouldn't say anything about African Americans, but they have no qualms when it comes to someone who's, you know, Hispanic. Partiality can be shown, respect of persons, politically. because of family. Now, family members. Sometimes it's very difficult to be even-handed with family members. And when that doesn't happen, that's respect of persons too. I can think of a congregation where there was a man there, a young man, I don't know, he's in his 30s. And if anyone's actions and anyone's life that they were living cried out to be disciplined, this young man did. And yet, his father was an elder. You probably can guess the rest of the story. He was not disciplined at all. And yet others who did what he did were. That's respect of persons. It could be because of popularity, however that popularity, you know, comes about. It could be because of rank. A person holds a higher rank in whatever it is, at work or out here in the community or whatever. It could be because of friendship. You know, we can show respect of persons due to friendship. And here's another thing. We can show respect of persons out of fear for who the person is, the power that they might wield. Now, that's just a partial list. There's many other ways that this could happen. And yet, sometimes we don't think about that. We don't think about it at all. But now, that's respect of persons. One of the things that we learn in the Scriptures, and it's pretty clear, God has no partiality, no respect of persons. And you can read that in Romans chapter 2 and verse 11. Very few words in that verse, very clear, very to the point. There is no partiality, no respect of persons with God, none. That really would be enough. That would be enough for one to read that and realize, well, if God doesn't show any partiality, then neither should I. And that would be right. That'd be accurate. But now, that's not the only case of this. Well, Jesus doesn't have any partiality either. When he was asked about which is the greatest commandment in the law, we're all familiar that he said, well, this is the first. And that was to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Then he says, and the second is like unto it, you will love your neighbor as yourself. So essentially there, in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 39, he's saying, you're not going to show any partiality either for or against someone who's your neighbor. And who is that neighbor? You remember the parable of the Good Samaritan? Who is neighbor to this man? What's the whole point of that? The person that's the neighbor is the next person you meet. That's how that works. And there's no part. Jesus had no partiality. So God doesn't have partiality. And Jesus doesn't have partiality. And then you go back to James chapter 2 and verse 1. My brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism or respect of persons or partiality. So for disciples, there's not supposed to be any partiality either. And we never see it with God, and we never see it with Jesus. But sometimes we see it with disciples. You know, it's always been a matter of curiosity to me that Peter, the person who learned the lesson that there should be no partiality, later on, Galatians chapter 2, was showing partiality. And he was wrong. And Paul pointed out he was wrong and did this in front of everyone because what he had done was open. And so it had to be handled openly. And he said before them all, this is wrong. Peter stood to be blamed. And so, you know, another thing I can learn from this is, well, we can make mistakes. Peter made a whopper here. And yet, it's something that could be and should be corrected. So that's something to learn from that. So let's go through this and look at several passages. Now, we've looked at verse 1 there. And what I'd like for us to see is that Jesus Christ is the Lord of glory. And what we learn in here is that the disciple, or pupil, as some translations might have, is to be like, disciples are to be like their teachers. The pupils be like the teacher. The disciple like the teacher. Luke chapter 6 and verse 40. Doesn't rise above the teacher, but he's to be like the teacher. Well, we as disciples are to be like our teacher. And our teacher doesn't have any partiality. Well, neither should we. And what else do we find here? Well, we find, if you go to Revelation for just a minute, chapter 5. Now, when we think about him being the Lord of glory and being in glory and offering glory to the disciples, we would find in Revelation chapter 5, verse 9, that they sang a new song saying, "Worthy are you to take the book and break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood." Now watch. "Men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation." Well, that's who Jesus accepted. Well, we should accept the same. In Revelation chapter 7 and verse 9, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation, all tribes, all peoples, all tongues, they were standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands." There they were, and a vision of glory with Christ, and all peoples, all the world, whoever so will. Kind of like what Peter said, in every nation. You know, those that would fear God and work righteousness are accepted by him. The second thing we would find, you drop down to verse 4 in James chapter 2. It's about, now, if you do this stuff, if you get involved in respect of persons, you haven't you made distinctions among yourselves? Right, we shouldn't do, but now if you've done that, now look what he says, "You become judges with evil motives." Think about that. So you become judges with evil motives or evil thoughts, if you will. And the Bible speaks about incorrect judging. Now, here's where the mistake is made. People go over here and they look at those passages. Well, let's just take a look at them in Matthew chapter 7. And they look at this, and you know what people do? They read verse 1 and then they quit. They don't go any further. "Oh, do not judge so you will not be judged." And there it is, and judging is just out. That's what people do. And sometimes brethren who have studied the scriptures a lot fall prey to this. You know, we do this because somebody will say, "Oh, well now," and somebody who knows little about the Bible will say to someone who's trying to teach them, "Oh, wait a minute, now you're judging me, and you know you're not supposed to judge." And what happens then? Well, everybody backs off as though that were the case, that were true, and you can't say anything. How would you know them by their fruits? Without making a judgment. How would you do that? Which Jesus said, that's what you ought to do. How would you know? Well, anyway. But in the context here, it goes on, see, down through verse 1 through 5. "In the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you." Well, what's wrong with this? Well, what's wrong with this is that you've got this, you see this speck in your brother's eye, and don't see the beam or the log that's in yours. It's not balanced, is what the problem is. And then in verse 4, you know, "Let me take the speck out of your eye." You know, this is a big deal. Well, and then he says in verse 5, well, this is hypocrisy. Well, of course it is. So what you have here is not that judgment is wrong, period, like some think. It's incorrect or improper judgment that produces hypocrisy. That's what the problem is. And one of the reasons that we know that is because there are other places, for example, Jesus saying again in John chapter 7 and in verse 24, "Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." Now, here's the question. If judging is out period. And Jesus said, don't judge at all. And then he turns around and he says, well, now judge with righteous judgment. Now we'd be confused, wouldn't he? Don't judge at all, but judge with righteous judgment. No. So what he's saying here is there is a measure of judgment that's proper. It's all right. And people say, oh, have we missed on Matthew chapter 7, verse 1? Yeah, a lot of times we've missed on it. Sure. And so that, I think, will clarify things. Now, what they were doing in James, he's talking about there, is improper judgment. But now here's one more. And again, I'm going to kind of go counter to what maybe we've heard. Excuse me. For a long period of time, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Every time I've ever heard these used, I've heard them used this way. A brother can't take a brother to court. A brother can't sue a brother. A brother can't, you know, take another brother and look for some kind of a judgment when there's been some kind of a problem in whatever it is. That's what I've always heard. Something along that line. And I'm afraid that, well, we've really missed the point then of these few verses. Really what's going on here is that there's a contrast between this incorrect judging and correct judging that you're seeing there in those passages. And that's what it's calling for here. Watch. It starts off, if any of you, when he has a case against his neighbor, dare to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints. Isn't that saying that you don't go before the unrighteous, but you can go before the saints? There's a difference there. And then in verse 2, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? Wait a minute, I thought we weren't supposed to judge. If the world is judged by you, again, I thought we weren't supposed to judge. Are you not competent to constitute the smallest law courts? Can't you handle it yourself and the judgments be among you? But that's not all. Verse 3. Do you not know that we will judge angels? Boy, I'm telling you what, for people that are told never to judge, there's a whole lot of judging going on here in 1 Corinthians 6. How much more matters of this life? Well, it doesn't sound like it's just condemned altogether. If you have law courts dealing with matters of this life, do you appoint them as judges who are of no account in the church? You see, he's got a problem with the judges that are out here in the world. The problem at this time with judges out there in the world is that they were corrupt. You could buy off a ruling. And the second part of this that was wrong was that the courts, well, they were more or less used as opportunities for entertainment. They would go there and watch what was going on, and there was no interest in justice. There was interest in justice had already been paid for, so to speak. But it was to go in there and just watch, you know, certain people just twist and turn out here in public and things like that. And think, Christians shouldn't be involved in that. You shouldn't get involved in that kind of a corrupt system. If you do, the only way that you could be successful in it is become corrupt yourself. And then again, you don't want to go over here where this is just for entertainment and become a gazing stock for everyone else. So don't do that. Now, is there an alternative? Yeah, there's an alternative. Back there where he said, can't you decide this among yourselves? In verse 2, are you not competent to constitute the smallest law courts? Can't you handle these matters yourself? So in other words, if a brother's got a problem with another brother, it's not, oh well, it's just over, you know, and you can't do anything about that. Actually, you can. Don't go to the courts of the land and take care of it. Can you not take care of it yourself? What's he say there? In verse 5, I say this to your shame. Is it so that there's not among you, watch now, one wise man. Is there one wise man in Corinth? You remember that business back there with Abraham? How many people in the city? I won't destroy the city if there's... You remember he starts off with a number and he keeps paring it down? And never can get that number. Uh-huh. Well, now we're down to a much smaller number than 10. Is there not one wise man? One. Who will be able to decide between his brethren. Who will be able to render a judgment between his brethren. A righteous judgment. Not like these others, and incorrect and improper and corrupt. Isn't there someone? So you can actually handle these things among yourselves. And then what else? Well, that's not what happens. You don't go to the wise person and handle this among... Brother goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. So they're going to the don't do that. But that's what was being done. Well, it's already a defeat for you when you do that. You have lawsuits with one another. Wouldn't it be better just to be wronged and rather be defrauded than do all this? But you wrong and defraud yourself. You do this to your even to your brethren. And, you know, you can handle this and come out of this. Now, if there's one wise man that's satisfactory to everyone, surely there would be. And that person be allowed to hear both sides and then render a decision on that. And yeah, that would be judging. But then again, you know, the act of judging isn't wrong if it's done properly. Now, what was going on in James was there was judgment taking place. You'd become judges with evil thoughts. You thought that a person was this or that or the other just based on who they were. And so you become just as corrupt as those courts out there. The courts out there, their minds made up because bribes have been paid before the case ever hits the docket, so to speak. Well, you become corrupt like them too because your mind's made up about this individual just based on the respective persons. And so there's where that comes out in verse 4. In verse 5, curiously, they are despising those who are honored. I have decided to get the right book here. In verse 5, listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? Now, there are those that are among the poor that were chosen. And indeed, the poor received the gospel a little better than others did. But now, what we learn of this, when it talks about being chosen, well, they're chosen through the gospel. The gospel, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 13 and 14, if anyone is called at all, they're called by the gospel. So that's how they're called or chosen, by the gospel. And that gospel, we learn in Mark chapter 16, verse 15 and 16, especially verse 15, was to go out into the world and you preach the gospel to the whole world. You don't just go out there and preach it to the rich or to the famous or to the powerful or whatever the case might be, or people that you like. It's the gospel's supposed to go to all. And furthermore, when the gospel goes to all, anyone, he that believes, whoever that might be, and is baptized, will be saved. So we see this universal nature of this, but then also, and I think we looked at this earlier in Luke, but this time let's take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26. Now what we're going to find here, when he says, consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise. Now, that doesn't mean that there were no wise. Not many. There were a few. But not many wise, according to the flesh, not many mighty, and not many noble. And God's chosen the foolish things of the world, and God's chosen, you know, the gospel to be delivered. And it's those who are more likely among the poor that will receive the gospel of Christ. So here's these ones who are honored, and yet you're despising them. And that ought not to be. And as we pointed out, you know, this would be a matter of sin. And as we know, we're going to be held accountable for those actions. The improper judgment, the respective persons, all are going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ, receive the things done in the body, whether good or bad. That would include the respective persons. That would include despising those who are honored. And just to kind of throw another angle in here, and something else to consider in James chapter 2, you get to verses 6 and 7. Now, he says, you've dishonored the poor. And yet, is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Now, you're despising the poor and you're honoring the rich. Well, you're honoring your oppressors. Verse 7, do not they, those who oppose you, those who oppress you, those who drag you into court, are they not the ones who blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? You see all that there? And I just wonder to myself, you think about the Lord in regard to this and those who are quote-unquote honored individuals. And think about that for just... Now, I know that there were a few among honored individuals that did accept Jesus being the Messiah and believe in Him. I understand that there were a few. But the majority didn't. Who was it now who crucified the Lord? Think about that for a moment. Who was that? Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 8. Speaking of God's wisdom here, it says, which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The rulers of this age crucified the Lord of glory? That's right. The people that you're honoring have oppressed even the Lord. And then if we go to Acts chapter 4, and if we'll consider verses 1 through 3, as they, and that would have been the apostles, were speaking to the people, the priests and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up to them, being greatly disturbed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection of the dead. So they laid hands on them and put them in jail until the next day, for it was already evening. Now, who was it there that opposed the apostles? Well, the very people that, after despising, you know, the ones who ought to be honored, and you're honoring the ones who ought to be... You're honoring the ones who are oppressing. The people like who crucified the Lord, who opposed the apostles. And when you get over to Paul in Athens in Acts chapter 17... Athens was, at this time, the accepted center of everything intellectual. Education, philosophy, you name it. Athens was the seat of all of this, all over the world, and had been for quite some time. Rome had never produced anything that would be able to unseat Athens in that kind of glory. And yet, who was it that opposed Paul? Who mocked him at Athens? Well, in verse 18 of Acts chapter 17, it was some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who were conversing with him. Some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? That's not a compliment, by the way. It refers to a bird that would be out here on the road someplace, and would just pick up something here and pick up something there and like that. Just pick up little pieces of things. Someone said one time it refers to someone that's like a scrap collector. You know, just gets a scrap here and a scrap there. And it's actually an insult to Paul and his educational prowess. Well, he's just got a scrap here and a scrap there and so on. You know, he didn't go to any of the schools here. And he's not among the philosophers like we are, and other things like that. And so he's just this babbler, you know. And now what's he got to say? And others said, well, he's a proclaimer of strange deities. What kind of strange? Because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. You find out later on, these are the men that were mocking him. And we're going to honor these individuals. We're going to honor those who do this oppressing. Well, we've got it wrong. And not only wrong, but I mean, it's wrong that's just an insult, and we're just slapping ourselves in the face with this insult. Now back to James chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. We've looked at some of this, but we'll just look here for a moment. What's said there in James chapter 2, and I know that we looked at it back there. You fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, that's found in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, originally. It's used by Jesus. It's used by James here. It's also used by Paul in Romans chapter 13, verses 9 and 10. It's a fundamental law. And so you're breaking that law when you honor the rich over the poor. So personal favoritism, partiality is going to eventually, you know, break that. You're not going to love another person as yourself. You're going to show respect of persons. And again, in verses 9 through 11, it's clear that this is sin. Now the last point is on verses 12 and 13. So speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Well, we're going to be judged in this, is what he's saying there. Now, there is something that sets us free. And we learn this from Jesus. Now, sin enslaves us. In John chapter 8, verses 31 through 36, sin enslaves us. But it's the truth that will make us free. The truth will make us free. And what else do we know? Well, the truth is something that should set aside man's restrictions and man's prejudice. And in Colossians chapter 2, verses 20 and 22, you know, why are you going by these things? Why are you going by these restrictions? Don't touch, don't handle, don't taste, all these kinds of things. And those things all come from man. They don't come from God. And yet you're bowing down to these. Well, you're responsible for these kinds of things. And then the last part, there is no mercy for the one who shows no mercy. In the model prayer in Matthew chapter 6, and I think sometimes maybe this is part of this that kind of gets the Passover a little bit. But in verses 14 and 15, if you forgive others for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. If you do not forgive others, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. So there ought to be mercy involved here. But now here's the problem when there's respect of persons, there's no mercy being shown. The mercy's not being shown toward the poor. You might say, well, it's really being shown toward the rich and other things. Oh, favoritism toward them. But what about the poor? Well, you sit over here someplace out of the way. Or come over here and sit here at my footstool. How could you possibly do anything like that and think that somehow or another you still stand approved in the sight of God and that mercy's coming your way when you haven't shown any mercy? And so there's that aspect of respect of persons as well. When you get involved in respect of persons, you're not showing mercy. So this, again, is something that's a serious topic that we ought to really, you know, give a lot of thought to. But now in closing, take your songbooks, turn to songs that have been selected. Now, as I mentioned here, Jesus was the victim of partiality himself. You can read about that in the gospel accounts. But now, one of the things that you find out after you read a lot of that, you realize, you know, this was prophesied of him. That he would receive this respect of persons and ultimately be crucified. Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 3 says, "He was despised and forsaken of men. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him." Respect of persons was shown, and some people who probably later on were ashamed of their actions were involved in showing respect of persons. So he was the victim of partiality. Sure he was. But now here's what the takeaway is. He never practiced it. Even though respect of persons might be shown toward him in the most serious way imaginable, he never returned it back to anyone else. And here's another thing. You're not going to find one occasion when there was anyone who came to Jesus and he turned them away. Now, he didn't. And I think that, more than anything else, ought to tell us that if he didn't have respect to persons, neither should I. And as we've pointed out a few times already tonight, the gospel is available and open for whosoever will. It says at the end of the book of Revelation, whosoever will, that would be anyone. They can come and drink of the water of life freely. No restrictions, no limitations, no respect of persons with God. If you're subject to gospel invitation, why don't you come? All together we stand and sing.